Steve Skinner in here with Stacy Stein right now, joining us on the phone. He's got a landline. I love it. Very primitive, but very effective. It's Craig Childs, a wonderful author and speaker and adventurer and so much more. He's on the line with us right now. Good morning, Craig.
Good morning, Steve.
How are you doing today?
I'm alive and kicking.
That's good. You're over there in Norwood.
Yeah, out in between Telluride and the Utah border.
And are you hunkered down with your wife and two kids?
Nope. my life has changed a bit since we last saw each other, but I'm hunkered down. My kids are in the two counties north.
Okay.
Of me. So I'm hunkered down at my place out at looking from Colorado into Utah.
And Craig, what are you working on now? You've got a new book you're working on right now?
Oh, there's always I'm working on a lot of things right now. I'm just proposing my next book right now, so I'm dealing with New York, which is ordinarily a strange thing to be doing. And now it's stranger than ever.
Talking to Craig Childs, he has won the Orion Book Award and twice won the Sigurd F. Olson Nature Writing Award and the Galen Rowell Art of Adventure Award and the Spirit of the West Award for his body of work. You are an outdoor person. You could be alone outdoors for weeks, if not months at a time. Are you venturing out?
Yeah. I mean, not far. I'm staying right in my zone. Yesterday we drove around on a dirt road, parked, and walked back to the house. I just picked up the truck about half an hour ago. So getting out and wandering, and I was out in the backcountry when a lot of this stuff hit in early March. So when I came out I was in southeast Utah down in the Combe Ridge area, Bears Ears, teaching in a week-long archaeology field course, and popped out and saw what was happening in the world and raced home. So I am getting out. I'm spending, there's still a lot of regular work to be doing, writing that I'm working on, but at every opportunity I'm jumping out into the canyons.
Yeah, a lot of people think that they feel the pressure. Okay, I'm being quarantined. Now it's time for me to write my novel or whatever. I'm sure that might not be exactly the same for you.
Well, it is. It's amazing how much more time there is right now. I mean, I've like a lot of people, I've lost most of my income, but I still have writing projects going on. So I'm hunkering down and working on a number of different projects. I have magazine articles that are usually in the queue, and I'm working on those. But it's been a surprisingly calm and sweet time to be at home, because usually I'm on the road. I'm either in the backcountry or teaching or somewhere far away, and this has probably been the longest period of just being able to come home and sleep in my bed and be part of my home world that I've had for, I don't know, years,
right.
Maybe a lifetime.
Indeed. You've spent a lot of your time following different migration routes of early Native Americans and pursuing early Pueblo passages across the Southwest. And now you're up into the Americas, and you've been exploring artifacts and things from the Ice Age. What are you learning in this time of, this is a historical time, there's no doubt about it. Are you finding any parallels with some of the research you've done in the past?
Yeah, I wrote something not too long ago, I guess it was last week, that I was, when I looked at the coronavirus in North America, the map of outbreaks, and then I brought up a map of 13,000-year-old fluted projectile point discoveries in North America, and the two maps are identical. What's happening with coronavirus now, and what happened with the appearance of a new kind of weapon deep in the Ice Age, and I put those two maps next to each other, and it's you know, for me, it's not surprising because, you know, where people were doing things 13,000 years ago is where people are doing things now. But it was just interesting to see the comparison, to know that oh, the apple really doesn't fall far from the tree. The places of interaction and congregation are the same now as they were in the Ice Age, that you've got these heavy clusters on the East Coast that trickle westward, and as soon as you hit the Front Range, I mean, of course, you have the big coronavirus outbreaks of the Front Range, Denver, Colorado Springs, Fort Collins, and then you go into the mountains, and it scatters, and it's the same as 13,000 years ago. There were one of the biggest Ice Age sites, human gathering sites, is just north of Fort Collins on the Wyoming border, and people were coming from 500 miles away. You can tell because they were bringing stones from that distance that they were then working on, and so you're seeing these concentrations that just say humans are doing the same things. We're still obedient to landscape, to geography and microclimates, and I don't know how much bearing that really has on what we're going through now, other than to say this process is continuous and it manifests itself in so many different ways, but often in the same places.
One of the things you've written a lot about, Craig Childs, is the sophistication of some of the early Americans, Native Americans, like Chaco Canyon with their roads and their star alignments and things like that. I think you could probably argue that people have underestimated the sophistication of early Native American cultures.
I think we underestimate the sophistication of everybody else, of all of human history, that we, writing about the Ice Age, what I heard often was people saying, oh, did they have languages back then, or did they speak, or were they just grunting? Were they just these hairy cavemen? And I was saying, no, 20,000 years ago was not that long ago. These were anatomically the same as us. People were, they had complex languages, they had cultures, customs, and then, hearing the same thing about pre-Columbian Native America, that these were primitive people, primitive in that they didn't have cell phones, but they, like any ancient people, especially where people were gathering and doing public architecture, they were accomplishing extraordinary feats. When I've talked about the astronomical alignments of Chaco Canyon or so many different places in the Southwest, their awareness of solar patterns and lunar patterns over decades. I've heard some people say, well, it had to have been aliens, that they were taught by some other race. And it's just like, have you not spent nights out and watched the stars? You figure this stuff out really fast. And the sophistication you get is from your time on the land, which I think we're losing. We're not spending, well, of course we're not spending the amount of time we used to as a species, but I don't think you have to be that sophisticated. All you have to be is human and observant and pretty soon you figured out the system and you look at the Southwest, ancient Southwest, and man, they knew. I mean, I'm pretty sure that they were able to determine when eclipses were happening. We know that the Incas were forecasting eclipses. So they knew what was going on in the sky, and they had elaborate trade routes going from northern New Mexico and southern Colorado all the way down to Guatemala. So they were part of a big world.
Yeah, the world was huge. And if you look at what was going on in Chaco Canyon with artifacts being found from South America, bells, shells, chocolate, these other items, turquoise, it's absolutely fascinating how this network was really, really big.
Yeah, yeah. And they were bringing up live tropical macaw, tropical birds. And these macaws are found, their feathers, their eggshells, their pens are found across the Southwest. So you know, this was part of something much larger. And I think we look back at anybody before us and think, oh, they weren't as sophisticated as us. They weren't, they didn't have the deep emotions that we have now or the profound thoughts. And that's something I'm often trying to dispel when I'm writing is to say, you know, we're not that unique. I mean, we do a lot of amazing stuff. Our technology is extraordinary, but we still are the same people we've been for tens of thousands of years, probably longer.
What's really fascinating is that there are no texts from early American culture. We're left to their scientific hints, their buildings, their dwellings. And one of the things that you noticed are the T-shaped doors, which kind of follow a migration south. And I just find it fascinating that Chaco Canyon, for example, and of course I can speculate along with just about anybody else, and I don't know anything, but it seems to me like that was almost like a place like Aspen, except it was yeah, full of holy people. And so because the midden piles there don't really represent a large amount of people, but there was capacity for a lot of people to be there, and it's almost like people came and visited, but they couldn't stay. What do you think of that?
Yeah, Chaco probably was different depending on the century that you arrived, because it was occupied. There are people there 400 AD, 1000 AD, 1200 AD, and at its height, it looks like it was a pilgrimage center, a place that people traveled to. So you would look at excavations in some of the rooms and find that, oh, this room has ceramics that are coming from the San Juan Basin. This other room has ceramics that are coming from northern Arizona. So you can see that groups of people are arriving from distant places and leaving objects. And I've equated it to Las Vegas, probably in the same way you're equating it to Aspen. in Vegas, people show up and leave their stuff. They leave their money there. And I think the same was happening in Chaco. People were showing up and leaving their dead, leaving their artifacts, their pots, their shells, their turquoise, and being part of something bigger, being part of a ritual gathering, a religious gathering, and then taking information back with them. It was a place that I think tied together a lot of the Southwest, the Colorado Plateau in particular, and people would travel there from great distances.
Craig Childs, it's amazing what we don't know about Native American culture, especially really early stuff, so many sites haven't been explored, and there's house on top of house on top of house on top of house. How does that work?
Well, sometimes the time difference between the houses can be 700 years, so that a site was occupied. And then the climate changed, which, out here, small changes in climate will send you packing. So they would, if it got too cold, too dry, they would leave that household or leave that village, pueblo, and head to another spot that they had occupied centuries earlier. And set up shop there until the climate adjusted again, and then they moved back to where they came from. And there is a rhythm to this. There's a there's almost a language to it that you look on the ground and you see what kind of pottery is lying around, and you can say, oh, this was our place. You know, I've spent a fair bit of time, especially with Hopi, talking with, people about how they relate to these sites, and you can go back and look at the pottery on the ground, and you can say, oh, we have an affiliation with this particular site, and maybe if things change in the future, we will move back to this site. So they're nomadic on a century level. So moving in accordance to climate and establishing themselves in a place where they can return centuries later. And so archaeologists who are excavating sites will get down to the bottom of a kiva and think that they're at the bottom of the site, and then they keep digging a little, and then they find a kiva that's below that that's centuries older. And it just says that this landscape is a map that people use these sites to return to these locations again and again.
It's amazing. Craig, is there any location and or early culture that's drawn your attention as being like a goldmine of information data that we don't necessarily know much about, but is being discovered at this time?
Huh, that's a good question. I mean, my mind has been, I had a book come out last year on, the Ice Age, and my mind has been really heavy on that. And the culture that I think that's being revealed is one that's much older than we were expecting. That for a long time the, story has been that people got here about 13,000 years ago, and those are the first. But it's looking more and more like people were here 20,000 years ago or 40,000 years ago. Evidence keeps going back, and so that's where the interesting culture that I think that is showing up is the first large groups of people, or the first real human presence here, which I would put, I mean, right now, most archaeologists are solidly saying 16,000 years ago, but I'm seeing enough evidence coming up 40,000 years ago that I'm wondering, well, who are these people? Huh. And they're, you know, a lot of them are going back beyond oral history memory in Native America, but then I've talked to you know, one Tlingit scholar from Southeast Alaska who had whose knowledge of oral history really matched the scientific findings, and you know, saying that, oh, we arrived here 10,000 years ago, but there were already people here who were from 20,000 years ago, and here is the story of those people. And I think a lot of that evidence is coming out of underwater archaeology along the coast. So that's going to be the big next archaeological discovery in the Americas, is what is happening along coastlines, because Ice Age sea levels were 400 feet lower, so you had a whole different coastline, and that's where people were hanging out.
Talking to author Craig Childs now, this is going to be a very bizarre question for you perhaps, Craig, because you are a miner of the past in a way. A minor 49er of the past, and you've learned a lot about past migrations and past peoples and past cultures and past religions and past science. I want you to put on your crystal ball helmet and look into the future if you can. And
yeah,
I know you're not a science fiction writer, but let's say you're writing about the Earth in it's just short little period ahead of us, say 500 years. What are you seeing?
Oh, futurism. That's a tough one because I'm of course, like all of us, watching things very closely right now, and, going, okay, which way are we going to turn? Because directions we go from here will define really different futures for us. And you know, I don't have a one future that I see. I see options. I see a planet with, you know, with 30 billion people on it. which is not a planet that I really want to see. I see us being really adaptable, really figuring this out, navigating our way through diseases and environmental collapse and turning this entire planet into a concrete ball. And that's the future that I go, okay, is there another way around this? Is there a way for us to exist at smaller numbers? I mean, even the number we're at right now to, and I guess the future of too many billions of people, that's the one that I doubt the most, because I see us entering an age where we don't have to be populating as much as we have been, where we're not desperately trying to get a foothold on this planet, where we start to scale back, where we start to relax our intense drive. And I don't know how that will happen, and maybe I'm being optimistic about it, that I see a future where we are not as huge as we are now.
That'll certainly take some intellectual evolution, yeah?
Yeah, and the future is so much built on hope and expectation. I guess that's the reason the past is so easy to get at, because you can go, okay, this is actually what happened. And the future, I worry about it a lot. I also am very excited. I would love to have eyes on this for the next 500 years and see where we go, what we do. The strangest thing would be to come back and find that we really haven't changed that much, and it's exactly where we are now.
That would be very bizarre.
That's the least likely future.
Yeah, I agree. Things change very quickly in the grand scheme of things. Craig, I asked you just this morning, I think, if you had a few paragraphs of something you might share with our listeners. Do you have something that you'd like to read?
Sure. I've got something here. This came from a book that I put out with Torrey House Press last fall. Little book to fit in the back of your back pocket. It's called Virga and Bone. I thought I'd just read a part here from flying with a friend in a little 1947 Cessna over Monument Valley, where we flew through a cloud of Virga. If you don't know what Virga is, it's a rain that falls but doesn't touch ground. Approaching from the north at 4,000 feet, about 70 knots, we saw an unremarkable cloud, a vestige of a cumulonimbus, a thunderhead on its last breath. Beneath it fell a single drape of Virga. The cloud was letting go of itself, disgorging strands of spider's silk that tumbled toward the towers of Monument Valley. The Navajo word for water is Tua, the sound of a drop of water landing. Virga is a Navajo koan, the sound of one drop of water not landing, waterless for those down below. My word for water sounds like want, sounds like desire, which might not be so different from the Navajo. Can we fly through it? I asked. The pilot looked over at the sheen of drizzle, a single curtain. He judged distances and potential turbulence in the air that had been stable since we left the trading post half an hour earlier. He said we should find out, and tipped the plane, her wings shading us from the sun as we arced toward this floating steamship and its diaphanous trailer. Entering the Virga was not as rough as we thought it would be, expecting rattles and jolts. We instead sank into a well, our stomachs rising as we dropped. He increased power and lifted us back up. We could see raindrops, lone silver-gray beads streaking by. They hit the wings and passed my window where I watched them fall, trailing several hundred feet before hissing back into air. One drop hit the rounded windscreen, then another, a fifth, an eleventh. They were small as cooked peas, as ripe as berries. each became a small, staggering comet heading around the plexiglass, looking for a way off, a way down, wanting nothing more than to meet the ground.
That's author Craig Childs reading from Virga and Bone. His latest book came out in October of last year. Craig, that was lovely. Thanks for sharing that.
Sure, Steve.
Is there anything else you would like to add this morning, Craig?
Oh, I... adding that where you guys are living, I think it's an excellent time to get out and take a walk, especially if you've got some public lands around you. I know that it's a pretty tumultuous time out there, and if it weren't for all the death and fear of what's coming next, I would be enjoying this more. But I would say take these moments and really feel, get out on the ground, look up at the sky, get a context of where you're at. That's all I would add.
All right. Thanks a lot, Craig.
Thanks, Steve. I appreciate you having me on.
Okay. That was author Craig Childs, and just a great conversation with Craig this morning. 26 minutes after 10 o'clock, you're listening to KFFR.